Okay, our final doc is going to, Derek Sherman is going to talk about transhumanism.
All right, welcome. My talk is on the challenge of transhumanism. And I should say that this talk is based on a paper that will appear very soon in the proceedings of the Christian Engineering Conference, the 2019 Christian Engineering Conferences. So it's based on that paper that was written for that. I'd like to open with something that probably betrays my age a little bit. I don't know if any of you are in the same kind of era that I was, but as a child, I liked the television show The $6 Million Man. And it was based on this novel called Cyborg. And it basically, portrays this fictional character, Steve Austin, an astronaut who suffers a catastrophic accident, loses an arm, two legs, and an eye, and then is equipped with these prosthetics, which are superhuman, things called bionics that give him superhuman strength and speed and abilities that far surpass his original body parts. And the show opened with these iconic lines. You know, gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster. And of course, if you were a kid in that area, I'm sure you can recall the opening scene as he runs on a treadmill and performs superhuman feats of strength. I was jealous of some of my neighbor kids who had a Steve Austin action figure that actually came with bionic grip and had a little hole in the back of the head where you could actually peer through his bionic eye. And I remember coveting that toy, which is now a collector's item, I think. But anyways, this notion of being better, stronger, faster is actually the dream of an increasing movement called transhumanism. Nick Bostrom is one of the spokespersons for this new movement, and he's actually was the leader of the World Humanity or the World Transhumanism Association, which is now the Humanity Plus. He authored a seminal article called Transhumanist Values, and he defines transhumanism as follows. It's the intellectual and cultural movement that affirms the possibility and desirability of fundamentally improving the human condition through applied reason, especially by developing and making widely available technologies to eliminate aging and to greatly enhance human intellectual, physical, and psychological capacities. And his paper, which is posted on the internet, has this plot that you see here. And basically, it's sort of the working area of sort of normal humans and animals and superhumans and transhumans and what he calls posthumans. So basically the idea is to expand our capabilities in all these different dimensions through biohacking, genetic enhancements, technology augmentation, whatever it takes, cyborg technologies, and so on. The notion of transhumanism is actually an intermediate stage. The goal is to become posthuman. And the notion of being posthuman is to be new beings that have vastly surpassed present human capabilities and may not even be recognizable as human, as we see it. And that's actually the goal, transhuman being part of the process towards becoming post-human. If you actually look in popular culture, the notion of transhumanism is actually present in a lot of modern superhero movies. If you actually look at modern superheroes, many of them have achieved superhuman capabilities through some kind of backstory, which usually involves some kind of genetic enhancement, you know, getting bitten by a radioactive spider or exposed to gamma radiation, or, you know, technological enhancement, as we see with Iron Man and Batman and others. And so we see in these stories, actually, superhuman, transhuman kind of stories, creating superhumans and some of the struggles that they endure, but also showcasing some of these fantastic capabilities. And if you actually push back these stories, they actually have, many people would argue, roots in ancient Greek philosophy, you know, the ancient Greek gods and some of those stories as well. So that's in popular culture. But one of the important things I think that's good to recognize is that transhumanism is based on the notion of morphological freedom. So the notion of morphological freedom is a really important ideology, I think, that is a presupposition for transhumanism. And morphological freedom is the notion that you can use technology any way you want to change your body in any way that you desire. That's basically the notion of morphological freedom. And you can actually see that in certain debates today. But the idea basically is summarized. I've got two quotes here. Jean Elshtain says that bodies are thought of increasingly as the exclusive property of an individual for one to do with as one sees fits. Bodies are also construed as malleable and constructible. Anders Sandberg notes that morphological freedom is an extension of one's right to one's body, not just self-ownership, but also the right to modify oneself according to one's desires. And the idea here is not just to, you know, wear a jetpack, but to grow wings if you want to, right? I mean, this is in the bigger sense of the word. Now, if you think about technological augmentation and human change, we already do. In fact, I'm standing before you technologically enhanced with my glasses, without which you're all kind of fuzzy. Yes. And technological enhancements, augmentation, for restoration are not uncommon, and you know, we see that in prosthetics, in pacemakers, in cochlear implants, hearing aids, glasses, and so on. The goal of these technologies is basically to be used in therapeutic ways to restore normal human capabilities, and we can also augment ourselves with tools like telescopes and microscopes that allow us to see further and closer. And so on. But these technologies are external to ourselves, in a sense, although you might argue that cochlear implants and pacemakers are more embedded. But the idea is to restore normal functionality. And that's in contrast to human augmentation for enhancement. So the idea of using technology to achieve superhuman capabilities, the notion here, the advocates of morphological freedom, Jacob Schatzer writes, is not the ability to wear glasses or have surgery, but to have a tail if you want to. That's the idea. And Jacob Schatzer is the author of the book that's on the table down the hall there. And I think, to be fair, there's a fine line that's difficult to discern sometimes between therapy and enhancement. And in fact, Jim Peterson, the editor of Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith, wrote a book called Changing Human Nature, where he actually has a chapter, I think it's chapter 4, where he actually wrestles with that idea of enhancement versus therapy and how that can be difficult. The idea is that if someone's below a norm, should you use technology to bring them closer to the norm? And of course, that changes the norm and expectations. Yuval Harari once suggested that healing is the initial justification for every upgrade. And so I think part of the ethical wrestling here comes with what's the appropriate use of augmentation and what's its purpose. I think there's a lot of questions that come up with transhumanism, that this sort of striving to use technology. The vision is a brave new world of sorts, and I put the cover of that book up on the screen here as an example of a world where, you know, human suffering has been eliminated, and a futuristic sort of dystopian world, but at the expense of human flourishing. Here's a quote from Christina Lake. Transhumanism is wrong not because it promotes change, but because it promotes a dangerously thin definition of the good life, as if to be healthier, have a stronger life, or experience less suffering will necessarily amount to a better life. Now, I think most people would argue that, you know, using technology to push back pain and suffering is an appropriate use of technology, but I think some of the presuppositions of transhumanists are that the good life means getting rid of all of that. I think people like Albert Borgman have suggested that it's actually the friction that we have in life where we often encounter the living God, that there are some purposes for pain, let's put it that way. Craig Gay, this is another book by InterVarsity Press, which recently came out. has a wonderful quote here too. We can strive to improve our circumstances, but we must rule out seeking impatiently and by means of technology to redeem ourselves now. So it's this impatient that we're going to take a redemption into our own hands, and we're going to fix the problems that plague humanity, and technology is savior of the human condition. Now we can look even further at some of these transhumanists, and one in particular, and this has come up in another session, is Ray Kurzweil, who's very well known. And he's a proponent of the singularity, you know, the notion that at some point computers will evolve to such an extent and our understanding of neuroscience will evolve to such an extent that we can basically download our brain into a computer and live forever. And basically, this idea is one that is based on very thin and, I believe, faulty presuppositions about what it means to be human. To completely simulate the neurochemical reactions in the brain is not to capture what it means to be a person or a human. And so I think it's based on faulty presuppositions. But it's a transhumanist vision of immortality, of solving the ultimate problem of death. And it also involves discarding the body, which actually goes back to an early church heresy called Gnosticism. Gnosticism was this notion that the body was a prison for the spirit that would one day be released, and was accompanied by a disdain for the body. And if you read some of these transhumanists and some of these thinkers, you'll find that there is this sort of disdain for a physical embodied form. Ray Kurzweil says we don't always need real bodies. If we happen to be in a virtual environment, then a virtual body will do just fine. he goes on to say, actually, there won't be mortality by the end of the 21st century if you use brain porting technology. And then he talks about becoming software rather than hardware. Basically, this is a type of idolatry, I think, a sort of faith in technology to solve the problem of death, and is based on faulty presuppositions about what it means to be human. But I think what it displays is this neo-Gnostic kind of view of the body as well. And in fact, some of the questions that you might ask is, to what extent do our current technologies, and this is perhaps related to the first paper in this session, encourage morphological freedom, perhaps, or a Gnostic sort of tendency? Wendell Berry has this great quote, our bodies have become marginal because we have less and less use for them. We use them only as shipping cartons to transport our brains and a few employable muscles back and forth to work. It's a bit extreme, but I mean, to what extent do we live our lives on screen, and to what extent do we rely on our physical bodies? And if you look at technologies specifically like virtual reality, telepresence, one might argue social networking, the Atlantic had a provocative article with a provocative title, Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation? But basically it talks about how since the iPhone's introduction in 2007, teens are dramatically less likely to go out with friends, get their driver's license even, and live a much more isolated existence than they did prior to the introduction of the smartphone. And I would connect this to, here's some more questions that Craig Gay asks. Questions to ask about our technologies. Do our technologies enhance our actual experience of ordinary reality? Do they give us time to take life in, to really listen? Do our technologies give us time to think and reflect? Do our technologies enable us to dwell richly in places where we are most at home? And so these are important questions to ask. And I would say, you know, the notion of the singularity is one extreme, but to what extent do some of our current technologies also push us towards some of these Gnostic tendencies? One of the colleagues that I have is Jamie Smith, who's a philosopher, and he's written about cultural liturgies. And I think an important notion is that our technologies have liturgies that are associated with them. Liturgies, and this is the project that Jamie Smith has been undertaking with some of his recent books, liturgies have highly formative kind of ways of shaping us. Liturgies, practices, rituals, and our technologies actually come pre-baked with a lot of profound liturgies that shape our lives in dramatic ways. So they're also shaping us. And perhaps what we might think about is doing a liturgical audit of our technologies and our devices and see how they're shaping us. I think about C.S. Lewis, you know, in his book, The Screwtape Letters, there's this senior devil writing a letter to a junior one about, you know, how to tempt his patient. And this is probably not what C.S. Lewis was thinking about, but I find this connects with this idea of how our devices can push us towards disembodied experiences. In the one letter, it reads, "Even if a particular train of thought can be twisted so as to end in our favor, you will find that you have been strengthening in your patient the fatal habit of attending to universal issues and withdrawing his attention from the stream of immediate sense experiences. Your business is to fix his attention on the stream, teach him to call it real life, and don't let him ask what he means by real." And to what extent do our digital devices fixate us on the stream? I think another really important idea when it comes to transhumanism is the reality of Christ's incarnation. I think that's a fundamental biblical idea that I think is profoundly important when we're talking about embodiment. Christ's incarnation and bodily resurrection are significant, and I think the way to become more human is to become more like Christ. We're called to become more like Christ rather than through technology. Christ, the Word who became flesh, I like how John 1 is in the message, you know, that the Word became flesh and moved into the neighborhood. It's very embodied. It has to do with physical contact and place. Christ's incarnation gives us a picture of the perfect image of God as well, what you need to be striving towards. It shows the value that God places on physicality and humanity. And it isn't just limited to Christ. He went into, you know, the ascension is Christ physically going up into heaven, and the resurrection of the body, which we profess in the Apostles' Creed, is a physical, not just a spiritual resurrection, but a spiritual embodied resurrection, not a disembodied existence that we look towards. Excuse me. Christ's incarnation, in the words of Craig Gay, is an extraordinary endorsement of ordinary embodied being. Another topic that I don't have a lot of time, but it should be noted that there is a Christian Transhumanists Association. And I think it's important to engage with some of these thoughts. And the question is can Christians be transhumanists? Is that possible? Is that an oxymoron to be a Christian and a transhumanist? If you look there and you look on their website, which is easy to find, if you Google it, it's kind of thin. But what they do have is Christian transhumanist affirmations. And if you read affirmations 1-4, they look like just regular Orthodox Christian teaching, which I think very few people would have anything to debate. But affirmation 5, I think, is where questions start to arise. Their affirmation 5 states, "We believe that the intentional use of technology coupled with following Christ will empower us to become more human across the scope of what it means to be creatures in the image of God." And I think out of Christian charity, I don't want to be too critical at this point without engaging and learning more about what they're about. But to start with, there's questions that immediately come to mind. What do they mean by the image of God? What do they mean by human? What do they mean by intentional? What do they mean by technology? And the last time I looked around on their webpage, it was kind of thin in terms of explicating what this means. And so I think this is this is one reason why I called it the challenge of transhumanism. These are, I think, in the time that we're living in and with the devices that we have that are shaping us in certain ways, these ideas are compelling and very attractive. And I think as Christians, we need to engage these and take 2,000 years of Christian social thought and address some of the issues that we see in ideologies, I think, that are presuppositions that are associated with some of these teachings. So transhumanism, morphological freedom, I think, is something that is related to basic human autonomy, individualism. It's very different than the posture we see in Scripture, where, you know, we're not our own. We've been bought with a price. Our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. It's a different kind of posture than I'm my own and I shape who I want to be any way I want. I think of Andy Crouch, who wrote, I think it was in his book, Playing God, "Every idol makes two simple and extravagant promises. You shall not surely die, and you shall be like God." And I think we see these two promises peeking through some of this transhumanist ideology. I really like this quote from George Grant. I think it reminds us of our creatureliness, and I think helps us to remember to be humble. Most of us have forgotten, he writes, our true status. We do not have complete control of ourselves. We're not independent of others. At birth and death, we're helpless, and never at any time are we autonomous, the maker of our own laws. In much modern theology about death, it seems to have been forgotten that we are creatures, dependent on God's love, and not simply our own masters. So in conclusion, to be fair, I think the longings of transhumanists point to the fact that the world's not the way it's supposed to be. We see suffering, we see all kinds of limitations that I think are due to sickness and other things, and that things are not the way they're supposed to be, with disease, suffering, and death. And aspects of transhumanist philosophy, I think, can be really enticing to people. And I would suggest that the liturgical kind of aspects of our technologies are encouraging us to think and be open to some of these things in more ways than we might acknowledge. There's something that the liturgical habits and practices operate on us under the hood, almost unawares, changing our attitudes and our perspectives on things. So the issue with transhumanism, I would suggest, is that it looks to technology to fix or enhance or to solve the human condition instead of God, or, you know, perhaps more charitably, or in addition to God, which I think is also a problem. I think it, in the end, it's a kind of idolatry that we need to watch out for. I would put in a quick plug for an upcoming issue of the Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith, where there will be a special issue dedicated to the topic of transhumanism. And it's going to be co-edited by David Winyard. And if you Google that, you'll find the call for papers online. And you can contact him directly or talk to Jim Peterson here at the conference about the details about that. And a second plug, the current June issue of the Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith is a special topic issue on artificial intelligence. And if you haven't seen that, please look for that. And then finally, two books that are really, really helpful, Transhumanism and the Image of God, which is on the shelf down the hallway here, Jacob Schatzer, and Modern Technology and the Human Future by Craig Gay from Regent College, where we heard someone earlier today from Regent. And then shameless plug, Shaping a Digital World is my own book on technology and computing in general, also an IVP book. But the other two books are specifically on transhumanism. So thank you very much. I'll end it there.
Yeah, I'll make a comment. David, Winyard gave a talk. He's given several transhuman talks.
Okay.
And he gave one last year in the digital technology session. And I'd say he pretty much agreed with you.
And really?
He talked about the Christian humanists and some
okay.
stuff. Yeah. If that one's online, you can check it out.
I think he did write a paper, like a call for papers paper of sorts that you can download there.
I have one question, and that is that I get this predominantly from my wife, who's a therapist. Mm-hmm. And there are certain elements that make survival of humans possible. For example, sleep and nutrition and a certain level of exercise and so forth. One of them is relationship. If you took any human completely out of relationship, they can't live. And one thing I've noticed with everything I've seen, and I'm wondering if anybody's been studying this, it seems that people that promote transhumanism completely ignore that. But that's a very, very well documented. I mean, if they talk about physical health, or other negative things that cause people to die. Well, that's one thing that caused people to die, and that can, it seems to me that transhumanism is, is that true, or have people been thinking about how can we use transhumanism to help relationships and mm-hmm. that need that all humans have for relationships?
I think the bigger question is, what does it mean to be a human being fully alive? What does it mean to flourish, you know, in the larger holistic sort of sense of the word beyond?
Well, that's an element of it, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, 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 and it's multi-aspectual. It isn't just having working parts. It's you know, it's being who we're, and the way that we see how to flourish, what it means to be fully human, is in the image of Christ, actually, as the model for that.
Even people that don't believe in Jesus will accede to the fact that humans require relationships.
Yeah. And I think if you look at social science and psychology, positive psychology, and all these other areas, you'll see that creationally that we can see that. I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
The limited exposure that I have to transhumanist ideas seem to focus on like hardware improvements or enhancements. Mm-hmm. But what about chemical enhancements? I'm sure if you're old enough to remember Steve Austin, you also remember a book called Flowers for Algernon. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't know that book.
Was mentally handicapped, took a drug, took a pill every day, and it turned him into a super intellect. So, are there discussions of those kinds?
I think transhumanists would be open to any technology or medium that could be used for enhancement, genetic, chemical, cyborg implants. Any kind of enhancement that could aid, including chemical. And in fact, there are chemicals that can make you sharper, and you know, people are sometimes tempted to take these for those reasons. Students, yeah, and I think the whole thing with the Olympics and having people take supplements or steroids or other performance enhancing drugs has been a big issue as well in terms of setting So, may I keep going, Tim? Okay. Yeah.
I don't walk in computer science circles too much, but I've always wondered in thinking about this. Have you talked to folks who are interested in transhumanism about what it would actually be like to live, to try to gain immortality, which I gather is the purpose, right? To essentially live as long as you want or forever, to live forever without sin being dealt with. Without hardening of sin over century after century after century, and holy cow, I'm in my late 50s, and I figure, Lord.
Come quickly.
I'm ready.
Well, if you think about it, the angel, after they were expelled from the garden, the angel with the flaming sword that protected the people from partaking of the tree of life was a tremendous blessing, you know, that they would, you know, not to live perpetually in this sinful state. Based on my Christian presuppositions, I don't think it's possible. I think it's, you know, I don't think we can solve the problem of our mortality, that the wages of sin is death, and that's a reality of what it means to be a human on this side of Christ coming back. But, I mean, a thought experiment of would you want to live forever in a fallen world, I think... is an interesting philosophical exercise, perhaps.
And really briefly along those lines, one thing is to distinguish between illness and aging, because even if you remove all the illness-related death, there is kind of a upper limit that people have observed in terms of age, around 20 years or so.
Right, but Kurzweil would say, well, then that's when we actually just we become software, we just go to a different hardware, you know, kind of platform, and dispose of our bodies. And
you're probably familiar with the title of this. I don't recall, but I saw a documentary about him once, and he was like a walking pillbox. I mean, he was just...
Yeah. He's on a daily set of supplements so that he can stay alive long enough to when he believes these technologies will converge. You see that ideas have legs.
Yes.
That presuppositions and ideas influence what people live for and how they live and how they. I mean, they're profoundly important in terms of, you know, impacting how people see their life and how they live it.
Okay, thanks very much, Jared.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions?